In the dawn, before the wind came up, they went to bathe in the lake. Before they entered the water, Taita cast a spell of protection to repel crocodiles and any other monsters that might lurk in the deep. Then they plunged in. Fenn swam with the lithe grace of an otter. Her naked body flashed like polished ivory as she slipped away into the depths. He never grew accustomed to how long she could stay underwater and grew alarmed as he lay on the surface staring down into the green world below. After what seemed like an eternity, he saw the pale flash of her body as she came up towards him, just as she had in his dreams. Then she burst out beside him, laughing and shaking water out of her hair. At other times he did not see her returning. The first he knew of it was when she seized his ankle and tried to pull him under. "How did you learn to swim as you do?" he demanded. "I am a child of the water," she laughed at him. "Don't you remember? I was born to swim." When they emerged from the lake, they found a place in the early sunlight to dry themselves. He sat behind her and braided her hair, weaving water-lily blossoms into the tresses. While he worked, he told her about the life she had lived as Queen of Egypt, the others who had loved her, and the children to whom she had given birth. Often she would explain, "Oh, yes, I remember that now. I remember that I had a son, but I cannot see his face. Open your mind, and I will place his image in it from my own memory of him." She closed her eyes, and he placed his cupped hands on each side of her head, covering her ears. They were silent for a while. At last she whispered, "Oh, what a beautiful child! His hair is golden. I see his cartouche above him. His name is Memnon." "That was his childhood name," he murmured. "When he ascended to the throne and took the double crown of the upper and lower kingdoms, he became Pharaoh Tammuz, the first of that name. There, look upon him in all his power and majesty." Taita placed the image in her mind. She was silent for a long time. Then she said, "So handsome and noble. Oh, Taita, I wish I could have seen my son." "You did, Fenn. You suckled him at your breast, and with your own hands you placed the crown upon his head." Again she was silent, and then she said, "Show me yourself on the day we first met in the other life. Can you do that, Taita? Can you conjure up your own image for me?" "I would not dare to make the attempt," he answered quickly. "Why not?" she asked. "It would be dangerous," he replied. "You must believe me. It would be too dangerous by far." He knew that if he showed her that image, it would haunt her in time with unattainable dreams. He would have sown the seeds of her discontent. For when they had first met in her other life, Taita had been a slave and the most beautiful young man in Egypt. That had been his downfall. His master, Lord Intef, had been the nomarch of Karnak and the governor of all 22 nomes of Upper Egypt. He had also been a pederast and insanely jealous of his slave boy. Taita fell in love with a slave girl in his master's household named Alida. When this was reported to Lord Intef, he ordered Rasfer, his executioner, to crush Alida's skull slowly. Taita had been forced to watch her die. Even after the deed was done, Lord Intef was still not satisfied. He had ordered Rasfer to castrate the virgin Taita. There was a further aspect to this terrible situation. Lord Intef was the father of the little girl who years later became Queen Lostris. He was uninterested in his daughter and had made Taita, the eunuch, her tutor and mentor. That child was now reincarnated as Fenn. It was so complex that Taita had difficulty finding the words to explain all this to Fenn, and for the moment he was relieved of the obligation to do so by a loud hail from the direction of the camp. "Boats coming from the east! Stand to arms!" It was Meryn's voice, clearly recognizable even at this distance. They sprang up, pulled on their tunics over bodies that were still damp, and hurried back towards the camp. "There!" Fenn pointed across the green waters. It took Taita a few moments to make out the dark specks against the white horses that were already being driven up by the rising wind. "Native war canoes! Can you count the number of rowers, Fenn?" She shaded her eyes, stared hard, then said, "The leading canoe has 12 on each side. The others look to be as large. Wait! The second boat is the largest by far, with 20 rowers on the nearest side." Merrin had drawn up his men in double ranks before the gate to the stockade. They were fully armed and alert to meet any sudden exigency. They watched as the canoes beached below them. The crews disembarked and gathered round the largest vessel. A band of musicians jumped ashore and began to dance on the beach. The drummers pounded out a feral rhythm, while the trumpeters brayed on the long spiral horns of some wild antelope. "Mask your aura," Taita whispered to Fenn. "We know nothing of this fellow." He watched it fade. "Good. Enough. If Kalulu was a savant, to mask her aura completely would raise even deeper suspicion." 8 bearers lifted a litter from the boat and carried it up the beach. They were sturdy young women, with muscular arms and legs, wearing loincloths that were richly embroidered with glass beads. Their breasts were anointed with clarified fat and gleamed in the sunlight. They came directly to where Taita stood and deposited the litter before him. Then they knelt beside it in an attitude of deep reverence. In the middle of the litter sat a dwarf. Fenn recognized him from the image in the flames, the face of the ancient ape with protruding ears and shining bald pate. "I am Kalulu," he said in the Tenmas, "and I see you, Taita of Galala." "I welcome you," Taita responded. He saw at once that Kalulu was not a savant, but he threw a powerful, intense aura. From it, Taita could tell that he was an adept and a follower of the truth. "Let us go where we can speak in comfort and privacy." Kalulu swung himself into a handstand, the stubs of his severed legs pointing to the sky, and hopped down from the litter. He walked on his hands as though they were feet, twisting his head to one side so that he could talk up into Taita's face. "I have been expecting you, Magus. Your approach has created a sharp disturbance on the ether. I have felt your presence grow stronger as you made your way up the river." The women came after him, carrying the empty litter. "This way, Kalulu," Taita invited. When they reached his quarters, the women set down the litter, then backed away until they were out of earshot. Kalulu hopped back onto it and resumed his normal head-high position, squatting on his stumps. He looked around brightly at the camp, but when Fenn knelt before him to offer him a bowl of honeymead, he concentrated his attention on her. "Who are you, child?" "I saw you in the firelight," he said in the Tenmas. She pretended not to understand and glanced at Taita. "You may reply," he told her. "He is of the truth." "I am Fenn, a novice to the Magus." He looked at Taita. "Do you vouch for her?" "I do," Taita replied, and the little man nodded. "Sit beside me, Fenn, for you are beautiful." She sat on the litter trustingly. Kalulu looked at Taita with piercing black eyes. "Why did you call for me, Magus? What is the service you require from me?" "I need you to take me to the place where the Nile is born." Kalulu showed no surprise. "You are the one who I saw in my dreams. You are the one I have waited for. I will take you to the Red Stones. We will leave tonight, when the wind drops and the waters are still. How many are in your party?" 38 with Fenn and me, but we have much baggage. 5 more large canoes will follow me. They will be here before nightfall." "I have many horses," Taita added. "Yes," the little dwarf nodded. "They will swim behind the canoes. I have brought bladders of animal stomachs to support them." In the brief African twilight, as the last gusts of the wind died away, some of the troopers led the horses down to the shore, and in the shallow water strapped an inflated bladder to each side of their girth ropes. While this was going on, the others loaded their equipment into the canoes. Kalulu's female bodyguards carried him on his litter to the largest canoe and placed him aboard. As the waters of the lake settled into a slick calm, they pushed out from the shore and headed into the darkness towards the great cross of stars that hung in the southern skies. 10 horses were roped behind each canoe. Fenn sat in the stern, where she could call encouragement to Windsmoke and Whirlwind as they swam behind. The ranks of rowers plied their oars, and the long, narrow hulls knifed silently through the dark waters. Taita sat beside the litter on which Kalulu lay, and they conversed quietly for a while. "What is the name of this lake?" Semeliki Nyanzu. It is one of many. How is it fed? Previously, two great rivers ran into it, one at the western end called Semliki, the other our Nile. Both come from the south, the Semliki from the mountains, the Nile from the great waters. That is where I am taking you. It is another lake? No man knows if it is truly a lake, or if it is the beginning of the great void. This is where our mother Nile is born? Even so, Kalulu agreed. What do you call this great water? We call it Nalubal. Explain our route to me, Kalulu. When we reach the far shore of Semliki Nyanzu, we will find the southerly limb of the Nile. The picture I have in my mind is that the southerly limb of the Nile is where it flows into Semliki Nyanzu. The northerly limb leaves this lake and flows north towards the great swamps. This is the branch of the Nile that has brought us thus far. Yes, Taita, that is the wide picture. Of course, there are other minor rivers, tributaries, and lesser lakes, for this is the land of many waters, but they all flow into the Nile and run to the north. But the Nile is dying, Taita said softly. Kalulu was silent for a while, and when he nodded, a single tear ran down his wizened cheek, sparkling in the moonlight. Yes, he agreed. The rivers that feed her have all been stoppered. Our mother is dying. Kalula, explain to me how this has happened. There are no words to explain it. When we reach the red stones, you will see for yourself. I cannot describe these events to you. Mere words fall short of such a task. I will contain my impatience. Impatience is a young man's vice, the dwarf smiled. His teeth gleamed in the gloom, and sleep is an old man's solace. The plash of the waters under the canoe lulled them, and after a while they slept. Taita woke to a soft cry from the leading canoe. He roused himself and leant over the side of the vessel to splash a double handful of water into his face. Then he blinked the drops from his eyes and looked ahead. He made out the dark loom of land ahead. At last they felt the drag of the beach under the hull as they ran aground. The rowers dropped their oars and leapt ashore to pull the canoes higher. The horses found their footing and lunged ashore, streaming water. The women lifted Kalula into his litter and carried him up the beach. "Your men must have breakfast now," Kalula told Taita, "so that we can march at first light. We have a long road to travel before we reach the stones." They watched the rowers embark in the canoes and push off into the lake. The silhouettes of the swift craft merged into the darkness until the white splash of oars was all that marked their position. Soon those, too, had vanished.